Welcome again to all the loyal listeners of Independent Lithuanian Radio. Thank you again for tuning in. It's been a very odd week for me. Just, it seems like the guy upstairs has just thrown all sorts of roadblocks into my life to get things done, to get things accomplished. Whatever can go wrong did go wrong, but in the end, we survived. I always like sharing a little bit about what's going on in my life, and perhaps some of you can relate to all that. So here we are, Saturday, and we're doing another Independent Lithuanian Radio show. Just like the post office, regardless of what happens, the show must go on, right? Or is that Ringling Brothers Circus or something? Anyway, in Vilnius, capital of Lithuania, that truly summer-like weather has got a couple more days, okay? It's 82 yesterday, and it'll be 80 tomorrow. And Monday will be 83. Can you believe it? And at night, 62. Tuesday, 80. And then on Wednesday and through the rest of the week, it will return to what you might call more normal spring-like temperatures with highs in the low 70s. Okay, 73, 70, 71, 73, 69 on Sunday, May 26th. So there you have it, the weather in Vilnius. So are there any fans out there of car racing, formula cars, drift? You know what drift is? It's a style of car racing. And one of our very own, Odimas Bakšis, and they call him Odie. ODI, Odimas, that's his nickname, Odie. He's in the Road to Championships series. Several drivers proved to be strong contenders, including Odimas, who finished in the top 16 in his Nissan 240SX. After successful practice session, he qualified 11th and was paired with Toshiki Yoshioka in the top 32. He advanced to the top 16, where he was paired with Darren McNamara under wet surface conditions. He had a mechanical failure and was unable to continue driving the car, finishing the event with top 16 standings. Anyway, make a long story short, he's had a very successful career, and he's getting noticed. He's thanks his sponsors, which include Nexen Tire, the United States Air Force, Feel Suspension, Torco Advanced Lubricants, 702 Graphics, Clutch Masters, EBC Brakes, Battle Version, Nitrous Express, Siki Manufacturing, and many, many others. To find out more about Bakšis' racing career and his drift program, you can find it at BakšisMotorsports.com. That's B-A-K, Boy Apple, K as in Kangaroo, C-H-I-S, Motorsports. .com. One more time, B-A-K, that's Boy Apple Kangaroo, C-H-I-S, Cat, Harry, Ida, Sam, Motorsports.com. Check it out. You might find it interesting. Our very own Odimas Odie Bakšis. We're going to start a new promotion this week here at Independent Lithuanian Radio. Okay, you've heard us talk about The Other Dream Team, that fantastic video film that was produced and directed by our very own Marius Markevičius. The Other Dream Team, it premiered at Sundance Film Festival, caused quite a flurry, and tells the story of the 1992 Lithuanian basketball team and how they went from freedom in 1991 and out of the blue threw together a basketball team and won a bronze medal in the 92 Olympics. They got to play the United States and they got to beat the Soviet Union, the team that they were forced to play on just 4 years before. It also has lots of great footage of the whole independence movement, tanks moving on Vilnius, you know, newsreel footage and all that. Anyway, what we're going to do is we sell this. This is sold at Euro Delimart Lituanica, Euro Delimart Lituanica, which carries a great variety of Lithuanian food products. Now, you're going to find Euro Delimart at the corner of Yale and Santa Monica Boulevards. So that's 28 blocks from the beach, 28 blocks from the beach, corner of Yale and Santa Monica Boulevard. Specifically, it's 2838 Santa Monica Boulevard at this little strip mall known as Yale Center. Best way to remember, though, 28 blocks from the beach, corner of Yale and Santa Monica Boulevard. You can buy it there for $20, okay, all day long. However, if you want to support Independent Lithuanian Radio, here's what we're going to do. For a donation to Independent Lithuanian Radio of $100 or more, we will send you a copy of this as a premium. Now, I know that that sounds like, well, you know, if I want that film, I can get it for $20. Absolutely. But we know that many of you do write us checks and you support us and you write us a check for, you know, $50, $75, $80. I'm trying to push you a little bit just to go that little extra notch. Write that check for $100 and you'll get one of these videos anyway. And guess what? If you've already got it, what a fantastic gift. Remember, this is has English subtitles. And it is just a great piece of, for lack of a better word, a great piece of propaganda, a great piece of information. Okay, propaganda is information. Just depends on what point of view you take. But this is a wonderful thing to give your friends or neighbors who have expressed some interest and know a little bit about your Lithuanian background or your Lithuanian heritage. But, you know, they're not quite sure about it, or it seems like stuff goes in one ear and out the other. You give them a copy of this DVD for Christmas or for, you know, birthday, anniversary, or, you know, next time you go over there for a barbecue, they'll find out more about Lithuania than you could ever tell them. So once again, promotion, Independent Lithuanian Radio, send your check to 2808 Santa Monica Boulevard, 2808 Santa Monica Boulevard, and make it out to Independent Lithuanian Radio. Any check for $100 or more, okay, will receive a DVD copy, brand new, of The Other Dream Team, which, by the way, again, sells for $20 plus tax. Okay, so we hope that you find it in your heart to support us and take advantage and get another copy of The Other Dream Team. Finally, today we told you last week, that we were going to have a special guest on today, and this is one of the women, who helped compile the data and the stories for a new book. It's not actually a new book. The book was written in 2011, or was put together, I should say, in 2011, Children of Siberia. But it was only published in Lithuanian. And once again, following on the heels of the incredible success that films like The Other Dream Team and Ruta Shepetys' book, Between Shades of Gray, works that are in English, the profound effect they're having in Western culture in the West is a reason that this book was translated very recently in Lithuanian and was recently presented at a book presentation in Chicago. Anyway, make a long story short, we were going to have Irena Kurtinaita Aras here. There's a little bit of her story in the book. But unfortunately, Mrs. Aras has declined to come on the air. She's a very humble lady, and she's a little nervous about her English. Okay, so her and I had a long, long talk, and I'm going to share some of the things she told me with you. But again, she will not be actually speaking over the airwaves. So we'll be right back to talk about it.
Love.
Okay, we're back now here on Independent Lithuanian Radio. Thanks again for staying tuned. Again, we're going to talk about this book, Children of Siberia, The Memoirs of Lithuanian Exiles, and personal stories of Lithuanian children deported to Siberia. Now, this is part of book review. Okay, and we're going to include Živile Gimbutas. Many of you know her, our very own Živile Gimbutas. She reviewed the book. And anyway, Children of Siberia originally was published in 2011 in Lithuanian. It contained reminiscence of 16 individuals who, as children, were deported to Siberia, young victims of Stalin's genocide. These individuals, despite horrid and depraved circumstances, survived and were eventually able to write their memoirs. The book was translated by Živile Gimbutas and published by Jaunasis Lunkas in Kaunas. Okay, so they published it in Kaunas, ladies and gentlemen, to save money on publishing, because these are works of love and passion. Okay, so keep that in mind, and we're going to ask you for some help on that in the coming weeks. Maybe we'll start today. Of considerable importance is that three of the authors, individuals who were themselves deported to Siberia as children, were able to attend the book presentation in Chicago last week. All three shared their personal experiences. Miss Irena Kurznaita Aras flew in from California. As I said, she did not want to come on the air, but I had a long talk with her. And from Lithuania, Miss Aušra Juskaitė Vilkienė flew in. Now, if you've ever seen the book, Children of Siberia, her picture is on the top half of the cover. Okay, these are like arrested photos, you know, with serial numbers on them. And anyway, so there's, and Mr. Vidmantas Zavatskis was also the book's editor and publisher. Okay, Irena Aras wrote the foreword and afterwards to Children of Siberia and provides historical data and background information concerning deportations and losses during this terrible era in history. Now, the memoirs are personal experiences of exiles coping with the injustices of the Soviet regime and perseverance. The reminiscences of children describe the events of deportation, hard physical labor, hunger, and schooling if it was available. And they tell of encounters with local Russians, Kakas, Buryats, Mongols, Yakuts, and other exiles in diverse locations. This is a composite historical, social, anthropological, and psychological account of an era that was shrouded in secrecy for half a century. From a child's perspective or an adult's retrospective, even the most dire circumstances can be rendered viable. There are interesting adventures, tales of events that were perilous and challenging, even funny, apart from tragic experiences of death and loss. I will briefly describe some of the recurrent themes and motifs, which vary according to the year of deportation and the locale. The worst year, of course, was 1941, and the most unfortunate locale, the Laptev Sea within the Arctic Circle. The details of deportation for some children are obscured in memory, merely the darkness of the boxcar, the rumble of train wheels, and the sensation of hunger for weeks. For older children, the events remain more vivid. Even those who were 4 or 5 years old remember the arrival of Soviet agents to their home and searches and orders, their parents' anxiety in being hoisted onto the tailgate of a truck. Švilpienė recalls riding into other homesteads, neighbors and relatives being packed onto the truck, forcibly leaving behind their farms, carefully tended orchards, windmills, or manors in Lithuania. Leskavičius describes the scene at the railroad station and the boxcar itself, fitted for deportation, with boards at each end, miniature railed windows, and a hole in the floor. He remembers the heavy atmosphere inside the boxcar and rest stops to get cabbage glop or water under the watch of armed guards. Several authors recall their arrival at the destination and being lined up as if in a slave market. Accounts of re-deportation from the first site of exile to the next are more detailed, as in Urbuniana's description of the journey in stages from Barnaul to the 82nd block in Altai, alternately riding in wagons, walking, being lodged overnight in barracks infested with lice and bugs, or Miloknytas account of re-deportation after a year in Altai to the Lena Delta by the Laptev Sea, a journey of almost 3 months by train, ship, truck, steamboat, and barge. After returning from exile in Komi to Lithuania with her cousin, Vilkina relates her experiences of re-deportation to Siberia. After a year in their hometown, 13-year-old Oshra and 14-year-old Laimuta were arrested by Soviet agents and taken via prisons in Rasene, Kaunas, Vilnius, Leningrad, and back to Kortkeros in Komi. The journey lasted from March to August in 1949, including 3 months of severe interrogations in Rasene prison. The memoirs recurrently mention the meager bread and broth rations, matchbox-sized pieces of bread for children. They mention decreased rations if work quotas were not fulfilled. They recount ingenious ways of obtaining food. In summertime, children pick berries, herbs, and mushrooms in the fields and hillsides. Zubinus recalls eating all the berries they picked before Soviet authorities came to inspect the barracks. He compares their existence to that of wild animals in the way they found food and ate everything on the spot. Vitamins that had accumulated in one's body during the summer had to last until spring. Mothers bartered items of clothing for grain, potatoes, or dairy products. They knitted scarves and sewed for local Russians to obtain food. In later years, some exiles managed to plant and tend their own gardens and raise a heifer or a suckling pig at the risk of arousing the jealousy of local Russians and being reported to authorities. Nevertheless, there were cases of rickets, starvation, near starvation, when no bread was delivered due to blizzards or simply inept management, or rations were canceled because of not meeting work quotas, usually due to illness. On Tromfosk Island in the Laptev Sea, there were only fish caught with nets through holes in the ice. As recalled by Ambromaitis, many older exiles succumbed to illness and starvation and passed on during the first year. Children hardly saw their parents. They worked at logging, fishing, fish processing, forest clearing, sawing and splitting wood, farm work, field work, or herding animals. Images of exhausted, wet, tired, and ragged parents returning from work are engraved in their minds, as are images of mothers doing extra work in the evenings. And the children did chores. They collected firewood, they tended furnaces, they drew water, they scavenged for food and prepared meals. After school was out, from May through mid-fall, children did field work. For example, Zuvanus recounts work in the state's oat fields in hot weather with no gloves, no food, no water, but lots of nettles. From the age of 12 or 13, children were conscripted into regular labor. I'll come back to this point. Up till that age, we'll talk about it now, they're considered children, and they get to go to school, okay? But if they go to school, the parents have to provide them with food to go to school. And because food was such a scarcity and there were, no rations, kids didn't get school lunch, all right? Parents were reluctant to let their children go to school. I will go now to something that Mrs. Ariena told me, okay? She told me that she threw a tantrum, that she climbed up in the attic and cried for days and said, "You have to let me go to school," because she had worked that summer in the fields. Summer school was out and the kids went to work, children went to work. It was so backbreaking and so grueling that she stayed up in the attic for days and cried till her parents finally relented, because they didn't have the food to send her to school, and they allowed her to go to school again, which just, it was the best thing that she could imagine. Anyway, back to the notes from the book. Ambrozaitytė recalls labor in a giant sawmill where she began to work when she was 11. "That cold morning, I hurried down to my first day of work, along with cheerless grown-ups. I waited at the labor exchange office for my assignment and soon joined a group of three workers. Our group followed the brigade leader to the rows of wood piles, referred to as stacks, pointing to the top, which seemed as high as the clouds to me," the brigade leader said. "So get to work." I would have to get to the top of the highest stack, lift boards from it, and throw them down to other members of the work crew, who would have to pile and align them on runners so that the entire stack could be hauled away on a straddle truck. I stood there figuring out how I could reach the top. I had no ladder or rope or anything to hold on to. The day's work quota was high, several stacks per shift, so I had to attack it without delay. I started climbing up, board by board. I had to hurry because sluggishness by one member might cost everyone's food ration. I had to throw down as many boards as I could as quickly as possible. With this goal in mind, I thrust myself into battle with the enemy, the massive stack of lumber. I was suddenly transformed into a centipede, my hands and feet clutching at boards as I clambered up the vertical wall. Before I knew it, I was at the top. The fortress was mine. Now, Irena Kurtinaita Aras, I'm just going to call her Miss Aras, okay, who I spoke with. She was deported in 1949 in March. Okay, now most of you listening, okay, think of the deportations that happened in what we call Bajsusis Birjadis, the terrible June, which is 1941. This is 1949, known as Operation Priboy. Okay, that translates as the coastal surf, code name for Soviet mass deportation from the Baltics on March 25th through 28th, 1949. Some 90,000 Estonians, Latvians, and Lithuanians, 90,000, a lot more than in 1941, okay, labeled as enemies of the people, were deported to inhospitable areas of the Soviet Union. It was one of the most complex deportation operations engineered by the Soviets during the Cold War. Okay, this was portrayed as dekulakization. The operation was intended to facilitate the forced collectivization of rural households and eliminate once and for all the support base for the insurgency by the Forrest brothers against Soviet occupation. So they specifically targeted anti-Soviet nationalists, supporters and kin of Forrest brothers, veterans who had served in the German military, and relatives of those already held in the Soviet gulag for alleged anti-Soviet activity. The deportation fulfilled its purposes. Within a few weeks, the majority of rural Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia rolled over and accepted collectivization and organized themselves into kolkhozai, or collective farms. Now, Irena Aras told me stories. They were, by this time, by 1949, okay, people are used to deportations. They're going on all the time. They come in waves, you know, 41 and 44 and 47. Now it's common knowledge that sooner or later they might come and get you. So they watch out the people in the villages. Okay, they watch out for things like movement of troops, more train cars starting to show up in town. Okay, suddenly there's more cattle cars being hooked up to the trains, and they're hanging around the local train station. So people sensed that something was in the air. Hiding was routine. Okay, people would run away and hide. And then after years, the futility of it all just seemed to get to them. They would shrug their shoulders and say, you know, where am I hiding? Am I going to keep hiding the rest of my life? And people eventually just quit hiding, and they sort of dealt with the inevitable. Okay, the authorities came to her house that night, okay, her house, and they took her and her father, okay, and they let them pack. They even let them slaughter a pig. Okay, again, this was different. They had lost so many people in 1941 in the early deportations. People were just snatched from their homes, thrown on cattle cars with nothing, and everybody died. So it wasn't working. This was supposed to be slave labor, and instead they were spending time and resources shipping people thousands of miles, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks, just to have them die on the way or at the other end. So now they took a different approach. They said, look, you got time to pack. Take what you want. Take the food you want. Take whatever. And what happens in her particular case is the wagon that she is stuffed in with her father and another relative is so full of stuff that there's nowhere to stand in the cart. People take so many personal belongings that the occupants of the cattle car, 30 people, literally live for 3 weeks in the cattle car on top of their stuff. They all climb to the top of their things, perch upon them, and that is the way they live. She spent 3 weeks in this a cattle car. And they were not allowed outside at all for the first 4 days till they got outside of across the Ural Mountains. Once they crossed the Ural Mountains, every couple of days they would have a stop where they could get out and stretch their legs, perhaps drink some water. They were always surrounded in the same manner by Soviet troops with bayonets. Okay, so there was no thinking of running away. Her job, her father entrusted her with a job. Her job was to guard their stuff. And she was a heartbroken little girl when they finally got to where they were going, okay? Where they were taken off this trip that took almost a total of 30 weeks. And when they got there, their bag of flour had been stolen. The flour to make their bread to eat, the bag of flour had been stolen. And she remembers feeling so guilty and so heartbroken that what would her and her father eat? More importantly, her father. When they got to their final destination, which was a kolkhozis, a collective farm, the women did the heavy labor. They were sent out to clear the forest, cut trees, while the men were put to work on tractors. Now, it sounds like that's easy. The guy's sitting on a tractor, right, going around while the woman's cutting the trees. Well, actually, the men were literally shaken to death. These old Soviet tractors shook so much that people developed all sorts of diseases, aches and pains, bones, literally killed people driving this. It was not any glamour work. The 14-hour work day was normal at the time. In the winter, they were afraid of wolves. They had to go out into the woods, and they would go in groups because they could hear the wolves howl. And more than one person who had ventured out alone had disappeared forever. They lived in a about 400 square foot, not quite 400 square foot, wooden shack, okay, 400 square foot wooden shack with one stove in there, and they lived in there with seven people, members of three families, okay? The trouble was is that you couldn't keep the place warm even though there was a stove, because if you didn't work, you didn't eat, so no one could stay in the house during the day to tend to the fire. So the fire was only lit for meals at night, and people froze. Tell stories about her hair freezing to the wall at night during the winter. I asked Irena Kurtinaitidaris what the worst memory she had was, and she said it was the work. It was simply the grueling physical labor, the back-breaking labor. She said it was terrible. It was terrible what these children had to do, and all for a matchbook-size piece of bread or grain that you were expected to cook yourself after working for 14 and 15 hours a day. We're going to talk more about this. Again, these are different deportations. This one specifically was in 1949, and we'll fill you in more background about how that happened, that operation that took away 90,000 Lithuanian, Latvian, and Estonians over the coming weeks, and talk more about the book. This is Kęstutis Deividas for Independent Lithuanian Radio here on KTYM 1460 on your AM dial. Thank you for tuning in. Tune in again next week. The book is called Children of Siberia, and it is the memoirs of Lithuanian exiles. Till next week, bye-bye.